Greetings to you, friends. It is I, D. Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, which I'm recording at Greynash, the name for my family's estate, here on the island of Cumberland off the coast of Georgia. This beautiful mansion has many stories, tales, some good, some bad. Many members of my family were married here. Many members of my family were buried here. It is here that my Uncle French got in a duel with a mud woman. He defeated her in this duel, but they say a curse was placed upon my family, especially the manor house here. And ever since, we've had to deal with this infernal echo. The echo of the spirits is what my grandfather used to call it. It might be something in the architecture, it might be something in the lime that was used in the walls of this place, but this blasted, ceaseless echo goes on and on and on. There's so many rooms in this sprawling estate. Some of them have been boarded up. Some of them seem to have been kicked open from the inside. I try to imagine that the things I've seen here are just a fantasy. For example, last night, when I saw the woman out in the marsh, beneath the flickering moon, veiny flaps of flesh hanging from her pulsating buttocks, that wasn't what bothered me. What horrified me was to watch her spray a blast of phosphorescent pollen spores from her massive genitals into the face of a raccoon that seemed to be inhaling these spores for some malefic reason that I could not understand. I will never be able to remove from my mind the vision of deer suckling at her breasts, sucking from them some foulness that I can only imagine tastes sweet, savory, and much like this island, infernal in a beautiful way. Swarms of mosquitoes carried my brother away 2 years ago, my younger brother Renal. And I come here to mourn him and to light a candle at the family cemetery. Yes, there are candles there, but I light a candle. A wickless candle where you ignite the wax itself and smash it against the grave and watch the sizzling, simmering, burning wax plop down into the centipedes that seem drawn to his tomb. I won't go on much longer. My breath is short and feels as though my mind is caving in. I should not have opened the book that I found in that room. I should have not looked into its dark pages and read the things that are written there. I cannot get them out of my mind. Regardless, we have a wonderful podcast for you today with David Arquette. We're going to jump right into it. But first, some quick business. Nanny, bring me more grits.
Hello Fresh. Hello Fresh. Hello Fresh. Hello Fresh.
This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the Saints of Cooking over at HelloFresh.com. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that is going to transform your life completely. Have you been going out to eat all the time because you're terrified of cooking or you've had bad experiences in the kitchen? Do you realize how dangerous that is to eat food that has been psychically poisoned by some angry chef? Somebody who would much rather be going through graveyards, exhuming graves and dancing with the corpses than standing in the kitchen of some fancy restaurant cooking for you and your family. Also, it's incredibly expensive. Also, it's robbing you of the joy of cooking. It's time for you to rediscover the excitement of cooking. You can look forward to your HelloFresh delivery knowing dinner just got so much easier because it comes with these cards that are illustrated with step-by-step instructions that are easy for you to follow. And they've got a wonderful selection, classic, veggie, and family. Simple and convenient, not a chore, because all the ingredients come pre-measured in handy labeled meal kits so you know which ingredients go with which recipe. There are many benefits of subscribing so you can keep enjoying your HelloFresh week after week. You can spend less time meal planning and grocery shopping each week and get that time back to do more of what you love, which for me is standing in front of the mirror, holding various parts of my body, and smiling. HelloFresh. They're amazing. I've cooked with HelloFresh. The bottom line is this. If you're going on a date and finally someone is coming over to your house after so many lonely days and you want to cook for them, you want to show them, I can provide for you. I know how to cook. I'm able to do this. You know, I can transform ingredients into something delicious that's going to sustain our family when the economy collapses and everyone retreats into the hills. I'm going to be able to make something delicious for you. And I ordered some HelloFresh. It was a wonderful Vietnamese dish. It was an ethnic dish, which terrified me at first. I thought, for sure, I'm going to ruin this. I was on a date, and I knew that if I messed this up, I was going to look like an idiot. And who knows, you know? Who knows what the result of that would be? She could have easily rejected me. Who knows? These days, it could ruin your life, you know, to make a bad meal for somebody. You could lose a lot of opportunities. The bottom line is, I, in less than 30 minutes, whipped up a meal that was so delicious, so satisfying, and so magical that within an hour, we were making love in the bathtub, pouring scented oil onto each other, shoving our tongues into every single orifice of each other's bodies. After that, we went outside and we danced beneath the starlit sky and sang to each other, our stomachs happily filled with delicious masticated food from HelloFresh.com. It's time for you to give HelloFresh a shot. All you have to do, for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code Duncan30. That's right. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code Duncan30. That's an amazing deal considering that HelloFresh meals are less than $10 per serving. Go to HelloFresh. Change your life. When you're wandering through some post-apocalyptic wasteland, do you want to, when you go up to the bandit camp and they ask what you can do, what are you going to tell them? You got a great blog? You've got a bunch of Twitter followers? That's not going to get you into the bandit camp. That's going to get your wife's head hacked off her body. That's going to get your husband strung up, potentially crucified. That's going to get your children sold into slavery at some bandit work camp. But if you say, hey, I know how to cook, I'm a great chef, they're going to open the gates of that compound. They're going to let you in, and you can go right up to the bandit warlord and shove your shank right into his throat. Feel his hot life's blood pour out under your hand and sit on the bandit throne and rise to power, potentially taking over North America and becoming the emperor of planet Earth, the Dark One, Dagon, the Lord of Light. All thanks to HelloFresh.com.
If you're ready to take the full leap into the inner chambers of the DTFH, why not head over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe? You'll get instant access to a lot more stuff. There's interviews up there that haven't been released yet on the main feed, including one with Mark Duplass. There's opening rambling monologues that last about an hour. I put one of those up every single month, and there's lots of weird songs and other strange stuff that I'm terrified to put on the main feed. Go over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. Also, a huge thank you to those of you who continue to use our Amazon link, which is located at duncantrussell.com. Go through that link when you want to buy something you hear about on the podcast or for anything at all, and they'll give us a small percentage of anything that you buy. It costs you nothing. We also have a shop with t-shirts, posters, and stickers located at duncantrussell.com. All right, friends, we have got a beautiful podcast for you today. Our guest is a brilliant actor. You might have seen him on Scream. He's also a wrestler. Not only that, but he is a really deep spiritual person who was raised on a commune and is connected to a family of supremely talented artists. Everybody, please open up your third eyes radiate as much love as you possibly can from every single chakra in your body and spray those sweet beams of pranic light to the astral manifestation of today's guest. Welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, David Arquette. These man,
bodies.
You get stuck in these bodies.
Yeah,
and then the next thing you know, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey,
man.
Thanks for having me.
I want to dive right into this.
Let's do it.
Tell me about Skymont.
Wow, yeah, man. So Skymont was a religious philosophy. It's called Subud that my parents were a part of toward the end of the '60s. They escaped New York, the whole hippie scene. My parents were hippies, and they believed in this this spiritual teaching by a guy named Bapak. It's called Subud. It's a sound philosophy. You can be any religion and part of it. It's sort of comprised of Hindu, Islam, and Buddhism. The guy who started Bapak started it in Indonesia, and story goes book fell from the sky and opened up, and he could ask it anything he wanted. So he was a student at the time, and Indonesia's a really interesting place. One of the islands is Hindu, one is Islam. So he incorporated a lot of that philosophy into it, but it's really about finding what your true gift is in life and bringing it out into the world and making the world a better place. So all these families moved down to this remote area outside of Front Royal, Virginia, and like 30 families. And then he came to visit and he said, "What are you doing here? This philosophy is not about isolation. You know, you should, if you're an actor, you should be out where they're producing plays and making films. If you're an artist, you should be where there's galleries you can show your art at. So it's not really the idea to sort of."
He wouldn't let you have a commune.
No, he didn't. He didn't want it. No, he didn't think it was healthy.
Wow, that is so cool, man.
Yeah, it is really
cool. And you met him.
I had met him, yeah. Oh, this is a funny story. When he visited Los Angeles when we were living there, he, my mom was walking me. I was kind of getting a little, like, I was a baby, so I was crying. And just so she had to walk me around. She was walking me in the stroller, and then the door opened, and it was Bapak, and he said, "Oh, he's here," and they took the baby and closed the door on my mom.
What?
I just took the baby into the room, so I don't know what he said to me at that point, but I don't know if I've forgotten it. I don't even remember. I was a literal baby.
Some kind of transmission. I mean, I was reading about it. Yeah. It seems like it's based around a type of non-meditation, an experience of something.
Yeah, there's something called... one of them says you're not supposed to solicit it at all. So you're not supposed to really talk about it here. I don't know.
Well, but is this considered soliciting? I mean,
no,
is it,
see, I'm not. So I'm not trying to... I'm just speaking
I'm
my
asking,
truth, and
I'm
not really a member of it, really. Although, if you're opened into it, you're a part of it forever or whatever. But so the idea is Latihan, and Latihan is spiritual exercise, and that's where men go into one room, women go into another, and they surrender themselves to God. So whatever that is for you, if it's being quiet, if it's breathing, if it's meditation, if it's screaming, if it's crying, if it's laughing, if it's dancing, whatever you do, you sort of roam this room and just kind of allow whatever's inside you to come out. And
are you alone? You're alone, or you're with other people?
You're with other men or other women.
Okay.
And you take off all your jewelry and your shoes, and you're just supposed to sort of connect with the higher spiritual level.
Did you experience this?
I have, yeah.
And you felt this, something happen?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you kind of feel it in your life anyway. Just, you know, I look for signs and like going around, if just if I'm thinking about someone and then I see something about them, or, you know, or if you think about someone you haven't seen in a while and then they turn up in your life, that kind of stuff. I always look for kind of little signals that I'm on the right track or
yes,
doing the right thing.
Yeah. That mean, so, and that's part of the sort of the whole, like, it seems like he was talking about the Holy Spirit or this sort of transcendent force that's everywhere that you forget about.
Yeah. There's a lot of forces he talks about. Overall one is whatever the transcendent sort of God spirit, but there's also the Nafsu, which is sort of the negative, sort of what I guess in Christianity you call the dark forces or
Satan.
Yeah, exactly. But like Nafsu can come in different forms. It can come in, you know, money, and it could come in greed. It could come in sex. It could come in addiction. So you sort of are aware of that. There's also the vegetable force, which is like if you smoke a lot of weed, there's a lot of vegetable force in you.
Wow. That
vegetable force has to do with, you know, the sun and but also weeds. You know what I mean? It could have a negative of aspect too.
That's really interesting because Terrence McKenna used to talk about how plants produce these things called exopheromones, which are designed like that are the way the plants communicate with humans is through these exopheromones. So when you're smoking marijuana, you're in direct communication with the plant mind.
I believe that. I buy all that kind of stuff. I think it's really, there's so much going on that we don't understand that I could buy that for sure.
You so this is sort of the religion you were raised in. Were you living in this one room cabin? So you're living in a one room cabin with your family on a commune.
Yeah.
And did they stick around after he came and said everyone should go?
They packed up pretty shortly after that and moved to Chicago.
Wow.
Yeah, my sister Rosanna ran away. She moved in with a family that we knew in Los Angeles. So she had a sort of destination, but she hitchhiked at like 14 with a 16-year-old friend of hers. She went out to Hollywood and made it on her own. She really.
How old were you when this happened?
I was just a baby. I was probably about 3 or 4.
Okay. So you don't really remember that?
No. No. Yeah. No, I don't. I remember we sang this song, I see the moon and the moon sees me. The moon sees somebody I want to see. So God bless the moon and God bless me. And God bless the somebody I want to see. And I always remember singing that, looking at the moon, thinking of my sister Rosanna while we were traveling. Because she always used to take care of me when I was younger. She was sort of like a little second mom.
So you how long, was she just completely disconnected from the family when she ran away? Would she check
really
in?
She really disconnect, but there was a lot of, my mother was a child of abuse, and she was really abusive to us when we were younger. And through the process of that religion and her, she, through the course of her life, became a marriage family counselor later. So she really sort of looked at all this stuff that had happened in her life and what the causes were and sort of healed herself and helped heal other people. So that was a really kind of troubling time at that point. And my parents were, you know, in over their head a lot of, how a lot of parents are, and it just was rough. And my sister couldn't take it anymore. And they were kind of, she was going through adolescence and that whole thing. So she went out to Hollywood and literally went and just, you know, auditioned and went to a casting director's office. And it was for like a character that was played an epileptic, who had epilepsy. So she was sitting there in the casting office. She didn't have an appointment, and casting director came out at the end of the day and said, "I'm sorry, we don't have you on our list." And she, "Oh, I'm sorry." And she got on the floor and started like doing a whole epileptic seizure. And she got the part because she was so like on it. And that led to everything. I mean, I think that one may have been a part where she worked with Bette Davis or something like that right at the beginning of her career. And, you know, it led to a lot of stuff. She got nominated for the Executioner song a few years later, but she did some great work. Baby It's You, some of her early stuff is really amazing. Big Blue, and she's just, I can't say enough about Rosanna, because she's just such a amazing spirit. I don't know if you've ever met her. Have you?
I've never met her. No,
she's incredible.
But I mean, obviously
bro.
Aware of her.
You'd be totally like, she's intense. And she's like, she's just a, she was a child of the hippie generation. Her parents used to take us to like No Nukes, you know, rallies. And my mom marched with Martin Luther King. And so we all had that hippie thing. But she really loves like hippies, and she like worked at the Renaissance Fair for years. Wow. And like, you know, she was totally into it. She's the best. She was like, we went to this benefit concert one time, in LA at the same place they do the Golden Globes, and Burt Bacharach was playing, and
rad.
And he's playing, and everybody's just talking and clinking and like paying him no respect whatsoever. She gets up in the middle. She goes, "Shut up! This is Burt Bacharach. This isn't some lounge act." I was like, "Oh my god, my sister is such a baller. She's just so like always fights for the little person." She organized the Alexis Arquette Family Foundation, which is the charity she put together for my sister Alexis.
What's the charity?
Yeah, the Alexis Arquette Family Foundation. Deals with transgender youth or LGBTQ youth and gets them free medical services.
Wow.
And
how long's that been around?
It just started, but it's working with this lady named Dr. Hagar, who's incredible. She's worked with USC, and she's got a clinic downtown and a hospital. And she's just remarkable. She's, you know, the foremost doctor and just on rape, like child abuse. So she deals with the most hardcore things in the world on a daily basis. Wow. And just knows how to deal with it, knows how to keep them safe, knows how to keep the women primarily safe. So she's just a hero.
That's your entire family is you. I mean, you come from one of like a famous family.
Yeah, yeah.
You have artist genes. Like it's all artist genes all the way through. And you, all of you are actors, right?
Yeah.
You have an entire family of actors.
Yeah.
So when you were being raised, was that part of it? Would they get you to read lines or
more improv? We did a ton of improv. My dad studied with Paul Sills. I also studied with Paul Sills, and Viola Spolin, my dad studied with. He was in the committee and taught at Second City in Venice. And he was just great. So when he went to Chicago, he really got more into sort of improv, and then came out here and they did something called Spolin Players, where it was Paul Sills you know, teaching all these, or just I don't know, curating all these amazing improvisational actors. They'd put on incredible stuff. I mean, we once saw there's one game called Animal Transformation, where you're each person's given a different animal, and then you act like the animal, and then you bring it up to human form but still maintain the animal characteristics.
Cool.
So it really gives you a wild, like, you know, if you're a bear, or if you're a snail, or if you're, in this case, someone gave him a caterpillar. So it was Robin Williams. He was a caterpillar, and we were all watching it, and then he's like inching around, and then they say, "Okay, now bring it up to human form." And he wrapped himself up in a curtain.
Wow.
And then he came out, and he was total flamboyant butterfly, which is just so like Robin Williams doing his thing, which he loved doing.
Cool.
But it was amazing, like on the spur of the moment. My dad used to do, they used to like give a suggestion for the beginning and end of a poem. And then they'd sort of all like come up with a beginning and end and then a poem in between. But my dad would always do haikus on the spot.
Whoa.
Within like, you know, 10 seconds, he'd come up with a haiku.
Wow, man. What a rare birth. Do you ever have existential moments where you just think like, why did I pick this? Do you believe in reincarnation?
Well, I do believe in reincarnation. I just found the same birthmark on my son, Augustus, that my dad had.
Cool,
right,
man.
On his hip. Same shape. This little, like, pickle, we used to call it. It's just kind of so bizarre. I was like, wait a second. That's exactly the same spot. It was kind of bizarre. But I think there's, like, always the combo of the parents and then this extra, you know, spirit in there or multiple spirits or whatever. But I had this trippy experience when my son Charlie was young, where I was...
How old's Charlie now?
Charlie's 4 now.
Augustus is 1.
1, yeah.
Gotcha.
And my daughter's almost 14, Coco. So I'm sitting there with Charlie, and he was still about even younger than 1. He was recently born. I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking about my parents, and I'm thinking, oh, man, I wish Mom and Dad were here to see you. And then I got like, we're looking at you right now in my head. Like, I was like, I was like, oh, they're looking at me through his eyes.
Yes.
I was like, whoa, this is a trip. I totally got that. And yeah. We get these weird, like, kind of things because my parents were so spiritual, or it's all in our head. Anyway,
not in your head. No way, man. No. Not in your head.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have that with my girlfriend, you know, and she, some like, my mom passed away of breast cancer too. My mom loves my girlfriend. She's yeah. got, but like, it's yeah. a very strange thing to yeah. suddenly have the presence of a being come into the room.
Yes.
And know, and you feel it. It's, and I don't think people, who haven't lost parents understand that happens.
Yeah.
And it's one of the strangest things. You know? Yeah. I don't think it's in our head though.
No. Well, you were asking also, the gratitude of, like, that's where I always found healing when I lost both my parents, where I got to a place at some point when I was just like, oh, thank you for making them my parents. Like, that moment of gratitude is really healing in the group grieving process, because then you're like, oh, you know, it is bigger picture stuff. I think everything's like a literal, like, you know, with time and space being what it is, that we're, it's a blink of the eye and this is another lifetime. You know what I mean? It's not like for us, we're on this, like, you know, journey or whatever it is. But for everything else, like, it's total legs. It's like, I'll see you in a second. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Because it's just like that. You blink and it'll happen. And the funny thing about getting older is you realize time starts speeding up.
Yeah.
It's really a trip. You're like, when you're kids, you could spend summers of, like, you know, having these crazy adventures where you're climbing through backyards and you're finding all this stuff. And it's like, literally, summertime's took forever.
Yes.
And now you if you just, like, turn away, you're like, oh, wow, it's Christmas again.
I think it's almost quantifiable. Like, I think if I put my mind to it and went back to, like, how long a typical summer lasted when I was, like, 8 or 9 versus a summer now, I think a summer would last of a couple, at least 2 or 3 years of now time, you know, at least.
Totally.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's different theories on that phenomena. Have you ever heard, have you ever heard McKenna's theory about, like, that, or, you know, Teilhard de Chardin? You ever heard of that guy?
No, I'm really not.
So it's the idea we're getting, like, that time is being sucked into something, like we're being drawn into something.
I'd buy that.
So, you know, like, you see those dumb things, like, they have them at, like, Targets, or they used to, where you drop your coin in and it goes swirling around.
Thing.
It's like, well, that's what's happening. So, like, time is literally speeding up because we're approaching this event called the singularity or the apocalypse.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's all part of the singularity and the whole thing, huh?
Yeah, well, like, I mean, it's a deep woo-woo shit.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you tell
this
to Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's going to fucking roll his eyes and, like...
Oh, he doesn't believe in singularity.
I don't think... No, it's just because it's woo-woo-y in the sense that I think physics, people who are into physics would be like, this is... You're just a guy who smokes a bunch of weed, man. But the concept is essentially... Where technology is going, it's I guess the idea is like, okay, so for, you know, however long humans were post-proto-hominid, humans were just walking around. Right. And they'd see birds. Birds can fly. Hmm. Humans couldn't fly. They tried all this shit. They couldn't fly. Suddenly we could fly. You fly and now the whole terrain changes. Everything changes because now we see everything from above, from planes, and then satellites, and that changes everything. The next thing that's going to happen because of technology, or theoretically, is we're going to do the same thing we did with planes, but with time. So that's like a time machine, essentially. Right. We're basically going to punch a hole in time, and that's the singularity. It's a time machine, and when that happens, everything happens at once.
Oh, wow.
And so we're getting sucked into that. And so that sense of accelerating time, or the sense of like, shit, man, a year now is like a day.
Yeah.
That's going to keep getting faster and faster and faster until it's like seconds. And then we enter into whatever the next phase of human existence may be.
I heard a bunch of these like super tech people all believe this is a simulation.
Yeah, that's it. Simulation theory is definitely part of it. That's this concept. It's more likely we're in a simulator than we're not. What do you think about that?
I could buy that. I think that's interesting. I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, I always had this question, like, what would God do if God was bored, if there is a God?
Right.
We would create everything. And like, you know, but then, you know, what would happen? You know, everything would be what it is. Like, we're all, I don't know, everything's being created anyway. So then if that's something's creating us, what makes it so that we're not that's creating us? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So then, I don't know. I can't.
We're like the crest of the wave of this creative intelligence that's pushing itself into time. We're all these little proboscis or something, little nodes of sentience that are pushing into time.
Well, I think everything is God. You know what I mean? The good, the bad, the everything.
Yeah.
Just everything's connected. Like everything, everything is just so much more connected than we know, and so much more like I don't know if you've ever done nitrous or anything, but I had done it in the past, and you know, there's definitely moments of like little, I don't know if it's just a drug sort of affecting your brain, but making it feel like this is like, you know, there's there's a connection, and it like I don't know, that everything goes together and nothing really matters. And what really matters in our existence is love, having fun, being creative, you know, enjoying your life, having excitement, and you know, not being a total asshole.
Yeah. How do you deal with, like, do you have any techniques you use to reduce your asshole tendencies?
No, because I go through these waves of like, we're doing really great, and like, you know, exercise is always great. I mean, I wish I meditated more. I mean, I've been to rehab a couple times, so there's always like, what happens, what's great about rehab is you analyze yourself and you sit in a room and you have all these hours to sit and talk with other people and sort of get all these painful experiences off your chest and deal with them and face them and write things about them and all this kind of thing. You also, you have a lot of time to think. You have a lot of time to think on your own. You also get clear and you get clean. You get time to meditate and do yoga. So it really kind of grounds you. So you get healthy, you're eating, you're exercising.
Yeah.
So you come out kind of like just feeling better in general.
Yeah.
So when you don't, and if you don't stay sober,
where are you at with that right now?
I'm up and down. I mean, I don't do any hard anything. So I'll smoke a little weed here and there. I drink too much. I mean, I'll drink, you know, maybe, you know, 3-4 times a week, which is, you know, just a little too much in general.
But what grabbed you when you were in rehab? Were you grabbed by one of the hard ones?
What do you mean?
Like the opiates? Were you sucked in by coke or the opiates? Or
anything? I'm more of a drinker. I'm like
it's booze.
I'm just like booze.
Booze is fierce.
I know. Booze is tough.
It's really, beer for you? Beer?
No, booze.
Just like whiskey or
scotch. Vodka, yeah.
Yeah, it'll get you, man. That one'll get you.
It'll get you good.
Fucking everywhere, too. I'll just
I know.
Climb right
if
on
you
top.
Can kind of like moderate it, it's cool, because then you don't, if you do it in a way where, you know, you, back in the day where you could just have a cocktail at the end of work and then just kind of settle down. But if you can't, or if you then do it like that for a little while being like a year or something, but then you start drinking a little more, then it's rough. I mean,
God, don't you hate it?
Don't want to make mistakes and like regret.
You're just like, sometimes I'll find myself drunk. And like, this happened to me recently with a really good friend of mine. And I wanted to talk to him, and not that I understand shit about feminism at all. Yeah. But my girlfriend understands it in a really astute way, and she's explained parts of it to me. And so I was trying to explain what she had, just parrot what she had said to me to my friend.
Right.
And like, you know, you have that clarity behind the drunkenness. Like, it's like you're a professor, and you're like, this is going to come out fucking great. And then it's just like, you understand what feminism really is. God, this is awful. I'm ruining it. Like, I'm the worst thing that could have, in this moment, I'm one of the many awful things that could happen to that concept. That's what I hate about booze. It reduces your ability to have philosophical conversations. You know, you're fucking, you start slurring your words, and it's just
coke, like, just coke talk is the worst. I've always thought like coke turns men into mice, because I don't know if you ever smoked it. Like, you literally become a little fucking crackhead. It's the worst.
You do. I got.
A couple times when I was younger.
You were smoking crack?
We did, yeah.
Yeah, I have many. I have some friends who were smoking crack. She used to tell me her lips would get all burnt and shit by it. Like,
it's the worst. It's so.
You got burns on your lips? No, from the pipe?
No, I didn't go that hardcore. I mean, I would do it like stupidly, but I do it, and then, you know, then way down the line, do it one more time or a few times, but not, but it's just terrible. It's just a horrible, like, it really makes you into the way dogs act toward food. It's like, oh God, I fucking need that food. I just it's really like,
it's that's so crazy. Dark. This is different from what I've heard about it. I mean, most people say it's like great. Like, most people say it's the best thing that ever happened to them. Like, you're getting into cocaine. They're like, most people are like, my life got much better when I started doing cocaine. So it's really odd. I'm just kidding.
Oh, God. Like, okay, good. Jeez. By the way, I'm completely the most gullible person in the world. That's how I started. Was convinced to smoke it in the first place. Yeah. I don't know when people are being mean to me at a table.
Oh, shit.
When people are like being like snide. We had a brief conversation about this. I have like dick gaydar. Like, it really has to be like, what's up? Like a confrontation when we're about to fight.
Right. Okay. That's great. Well, I apologize for that.
No, please do. Please, like, keep trying to sneak them in there. That's right. See if I go for it again.
No, man. Cocaine, like, I'm lucky because I don't like cocaine. The one thing I know that would kill me is heroin, so I've never done it.
Oh, terrible.
But cocaine, my body doesn't like it. It's when I snort it, I get like almost like an instantaneous ecstasy depression. Like, I'll do it. I'll feel that thing.
Yeah. And
you know, where you're like, oh my God.
You get the hate me's. We call them the hate me's.
The hate me's quick. And it happens so quick that it's like, my brain just doesn't work well with cocaine. No. Which is interesting. You know, I was talking to, I went to this MAPS conference. You know MAPS? Mm-hmm. It's the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies.
Oh, cool.
And they're the ones who are getting MDMA prescribable by 2022. Cool. You know, there's all these like psychiatrists and doctors and psychologists who come to these.
I love talking to scientists and doctors about this shit, because that really kind of breaks it down.
Yeah, and it's they're such like, they're so excited right now because, you know what, they're some psychedelics, they can really like heal depression, they can really heal like addiction, and they're starting to find out the mechanisms of addiction through some of these psychedelics. But one of the things this guy was telling me is that they're kicking around is genetic testing, that they can then tell you, oh, here are the drugs you don't want to fuck with.
Yeah.
Here are the psychedelics that aren't going to really work, might not work well with you, just based on your genome. Because the way everyone processes these chemicals is completely different. It's fascinating.
That is really cool. Yeah. I think that'll open it up to like a better understanding. I mean, right now is everything so fucked up.
Do you struggle with depression?
I do, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think I do. You know, I mean, I have a pretty good outlook on life, and it doesn't get me down that often. But when it does, it becomes pretty dark, and you know, I get bummed out.
It creeps in, kind of like it starts slow. You just kind of ignore it, and the next thing you know, you're like,
yeah, it's definitely in my family too. Like my father had it, and his father, Well, my family goes back to vaudeville. So, like, they were this little rinky-dinky vaudevillian group and a little team in Toledo, Ohio. And my grandfather, Cliff Arquette, was part of that. And he had learned, like, a lot of the sort of vaudevillian things. So he then went to New York and became famous on radio. And then radio died. And he was sitting back watching the Jack Parr show one time. And Jack Parr said, whatever happened to whatever happened to Charlie Weaver? Because that was the character he played. And he was like, he spit out his scotch. And which I'm sure my grandfather, Charlie Weaver, had built a kid's toy that's an actual bartender. He shakes up a martini. He pours it into a martini glass. He drinks it. His nose turns red and smoke comes out of his ears.
What?
And this was a toy he manufactured in China and then brought it over here. And it was like this huge, funny toy.
They got to bring that back.
I know. It's really cool. And so he heard that and he called up Jack Parr. He said, I'm still here. I'd love to come on your show. So then he put a visual look to the that's him right there. It's a tattoo of them.
Wow.
Yeah, so he used to read letters home to mama, which was his big thing. And he had a funny thing where he was kind of like a dirty old man in a sense, but it was all very clean, but he could get away with saying things that a lot of people couldn't.
Cool.
Yeah.
So vaudeville, man, and it's in your family, huh? Depression.
Yeah, and then my grandfather, his father, Cliff's father, actually killed himself.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so that's
something
to watch out.
That's something to watch out for, man.
Totally. You got to be aware of those demons, that voice in our heads, that negative voice that's trying to attack us all the time.
Yeah, it's Nafsu.
Exactly.
So how does it come about for you? For me, when I get depressed, it's like I go numb. Like, that's how I know it's starting, because I stop feeling. Like, I go into this numb spot, and then I start getting sleepy all the time, and then I don't want to get out of bed, and then I get plastered to the bed, and then I want to start pissing in the bed because I'm so it's only happened a few times in my life where it's like I'm paralytic almost. Yeah. How does it happen with you?
I don't know. I guess maybe I start drinking too much. It's pretty much, or that adds to it, or whatever it is. And then I think I start arguing with my, you know, whoever I'm with at the time, and that kind of stuff.
Drunk fights.
Yeah, I mean, it's usually not when I'm drunk. Well, I guess sometimes, yeah.
Well, it's
but
like,
not fights, just being a dick, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. I just kind of sometimes I just get so fed up with, you know, what's going on in this business or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, my dad was an actor for 45 years. So for us, it's like this kind of like, I don't know, it brings up all this stuff, you know, that my parents used to argue about. That,
yeah.
When me and my wife argue about it, just grinds me like so much. I'm like, I can't repeat the relationship my parents had. I just can't.
Like, you mean arguing over like Hollywood business problems?
Drinking too much, Hollywood business problems, just minor stuff, working or like making money, whatever it is, you know what I mean? But it's just, I mean, this is where I just feel it's all a waste of time. Like, everything's a waste of time because we could be dead in any second. So
right.
If you're sitting here having your argument, we're just wasting it. It's just wasted time. Like, let's either not argue and just, you know, I know people have to be heard and you know, you want people to feel fulfilled too. So you can't just be completely narcissistic, but
right.
It was funny. I've always been obsessed with narcissists, and the fact that we have a narcissistic president is insane. But I've always been amazed by them because they have this ability to not give a shit about anything. They're like, you know, that's what heroin does. Heroin just makes you fucking not care if you shit your bed. You're like,
right.
That feels warm. You know what I mean?
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, it's like, it's insane because you have no fucking care for anything.
Yeah.
You know, and that will include your kids or you know, your own life. You know, sometimes I often think people accidentally kill themselves, not even that accidentally. They're just
sure.
Most of the time they try to get sober, they relapse, they do as much as they used to be doing, and it's too much for their
system. That's the classic, right?
Or the other classic is keep doing it long enough, your body can't take it anymore. So yeah. you die at, you know, 50.
Lots of ways yeah. to do it. I can't remember. Some comedian, I wish I could remember her name. So I'm sorry if you're listening. I'm so sorry. She had a joke about how she realized that she was actually trying to break up with her boyfriend by suicide.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? She was yeah, in such I a totally shit agree. Relationship. She was like, she'd rather die.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Than break up.
By the way, that's how a lot of people do it. I think that's how a lot of people end up in jail, I'm convinced as well.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot. I think love and like passion and all that stuff adds to a lot of this.
You know? Oh my God. I mean, this is the statistic everyone says, because like having a gun at home, they're like, that increases your chance yeah. of getting shot by someone you love or by shooting yourself.
I swear. I mean, I you know, I've never really been suicidal, but I have looked at, you know, off a balcony a few times.
Oh, just me being like, too.
Could I?
Me too.
Just.
Oh, it's like what
it's
I
the
did.
Worst.
I
said suicide's so sad, and it's so like, I don't know. I just feel so bad for, you know, like a soldier a day or something, like,
yeah.
or like second, like every. It's just so painful.
Well, it's like one of the things Ram Dass talks about when he talks about suicide mm-hmm. is what we want to do is. It's not that we don't want to kill our physical body, but the mask that we're wearing, we've gotten confused into yeah. thinking that's us.
Wow.
And when people kill themselves, you know, it's this, they've become very identified with this aspect of their personality that they think is yeah. the totality of their personality.
Yeah.
Just one little piece of what
yes.
you are.
Yeah.
So the idea is like, oh, we can annihilate you. You can, that thing can be transformed. We can get some space around it. But,
yeah, but do you believe in like ancestral like pain? That
it, absolutely.
Yeah, so that it's not going anywhere. So it's you're passing it on, you know, you pass it on to your children or you know, other generations.
Hot potato.
Until you, yeah, deal with it and face it. And that's what
right.
was pretty amazing about what my mother did. Although in her abuse cycle had left some for us to deal with.
You that's know? Right. Well, I mean, and that's that what you just said. I was talking to someone, you know, because the idea is like, let's find. So the first time I interviewed these Ram Dass people, I was raging, and I was like, you know, violent revolution. When yeah. are we going to the streets? How are we gonna?
Yeah.
And they're like, I remember he's like, Duncan, look what you're doing. You're creating an us and a them. And you've created this big separation here. And the idea is we're not an us or a them. We're all a one.
Yeah.
And so I was talking to someone, I think it was someone related to MAPS, about these motherfuckers who come out in the Darth Vader costumes and beat people and spray them when they're marching. You know, yeah. those people.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The, like, who are they? Just the cops, the right. fucking beating, the murderous the cops who are, like, into it. And they pointed out, you know, those guys, they were abused as kids. They have PTSD. And what you're really looking at there is not so much an evil person as kind of the condensation of millennia of suffering bubbling into time in the form of these people beating other people.
Right.
So that's what trauma is. You know, it's this, right. just what you're saying. It's like yeah. a, it's like a drip, drip, drip of pain coming from the ancestors.
Right.
And yeah. And killing yourself, all that does is like transfer the trauma to the people around you.
Yeah, I mean, oh, if you ever seen anyone, I mean, I've been to a funeral like that. It's just so, I mean, you go walk into the Van Gogh Museum. Have you?
Oh my God.
You ever been to the Van Gogh Museum?
No, I have not.
It's amazing though, because it's beautiful arts everywhere. But everybody's like this. Like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's such a hard, it's just such a,
yeah.
like a vibe, like the, I don't know. But that's a painful type of a funeral to be at.
I can't even imagine. Everyone feels guilty, right? Is that yeah, what it is? It's like we could have done
know,
something.
Oh, yeah. And, oh, it's just so sad when it happens. But you
can't. But I've been told you can't really do anything. That's a myth. Like there's if somebody decides they're going to kill themselves, yeah. it's like cancer. It's like any other. Yeah. They're going to kill themselves. There's not much that you could do, except listen.
Yeah.
And not blame yourself for it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I've been told.
Yeah, I believe that.
I've called suicide hotlines because people have been like on the ledge, you know, and the suicide hotline people, they're like, well, you know, you can call 911 or you can do this, but you know, they're get them to call us and we'll talk. But they've dealt with it so many times. They know it's like, oof. If it's going to happen.
Yeah. Don't do it. Anybody out there, don't.
Yeah.
Because it gets better. Like, everything gets better. And, you know, getting older is hard. And, you know, the assisted suicide or the kind of suicide because of pain and all that.
Yeah.
You know, that's a whole...
That's a different ball of wax.
But Alexis, my sister Alexis, she had AIDS for, like, years. Like, since she was in her teen, like, late teens, like, or early 20s. And she had it for so long. And she would get feeling good and taking her meds, and then she'd stop because she felt so good. But then she'd go back on them, but that reduces their sort of effectiveness. So just toward the end, I could just tell she was kind of done. And it was like she was done with it, and she was kind of going to dark places and not really honoring herself. So she was ready to sort of like, I'm done with this kind of phase.
Did you, it was just a phone call, huh? You just got the phone call? Is that how you found out?
No, she didn't commit suicide. She just slowly did, in the sense, you know what I mean? Slowly allowed herself to sort of
I go see down, what you're
but
saying.
I got a call that she was sick, and then, and then we all sort of came, and I had somewhere to go. I thought she was going to live longer, and I went, and she got worse, so I had to come back. But we were all there when she passed, which was beautiful.
That's beautiful.
We were playing music, and all the brothers and sisters were there. So that was really nice.
A lot of people don't get that.
I know. They don't. And I sometimes think that that's probably the way they wanted it anyway. Or even if they didn't, it's the way it was supposed to be. I don't know. You never know.
No, it's true. I was volunteering at a hospice, and they would tell us about
those people.
Oof. Wow, angels. They're angels. They're just the most amazing humans.
Wow.
And we had to go through this orientation, and one of the things that they talked about is like when people decide to die. And one of the stories they told is really fascinating. Is they're just this father was just he was just sort of all. Hanging in there, but just not there. And the hospice worker was like, you know what? I want you all to go see a movie tonight. Go see a movie. Let's just go to a movie and then come back. And they went to the movie, and as soon as they were gone, he died. Wow. Because he didn't want to die in front of him.
Yeah.
I
totally get that for some people. Yeah. I totally get that.
Yeah. Some people want to die alone.
Yeah.
Which is okay.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's however you want it. I mean, a lot of people, I always say, we love you. We're going to be all right. You know, whatever. It's like, you're safe to go. You've been just sort of reinforce how great a person or experience we've had together, how much we love them. You know, just to let them know that it's okay to go. Like, we're going to be fine. Everyone's going to be fine. We love you. We'll see you soon. I do believe you're going to see all these people. I think we'll see them all, that we're all one. You know what I mean? It becomes very clear that this is all super connected. And you know what I mean?
Well, I love when Ram Dass's guru died. They said, when they called Ram Dass, they said, he dropped his body. That's how they say wild. It. Yeah.
That's cool.
That's as much, you know, in the West, the way we look at it is so different there. It's just like, this is a vehicle.
Yeah.
Get out of the car. We're all going to get out of the car. And some people's cars are like, they're breaking down. They're smoldering. Right. They're, Mitzi passed away.
I heard. I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't know you were friends with her.
Yeah. But these things are so bittersweet because you want a being to go on forever. But simultaneously, someone who's in a body that's breaking down, it's a real joyful moment to let go of that body and to become part of everything again.
Absolutely.
And you could, and now that you feel them, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure you feel your sister still. I'm sure.
Oh,
you...
absolutely. Yeah, totally. And you know what I always say, when you die, go toward the laughter. I mean, that's what you want. You know what I mean?
That's cool. Yeah. Way better than the light. That's so much better than the light. How beautiful, man. I love that. I mean, I guess it depends on the type of laughter.
Yeah. Yeah, you could go there.
No good at that laughter.
I know.
Yeah, I don't. Do you, would, if you had the option, you know, that this shit you read about, medical technology right now and the stuff they're saying.
Cryo-freeze the brain?
Yeah, reverse the aging process, CRISPR, all this stuff. Would you do it? Would you, if you could, double your lifespan?
The only reason I'd want to is for kids, or to be see my kids, like, do whatever they want, be there to ask them questions. That's the main thing you miss, is, like, being able to call my dad and say, oh, man, this funny joke. I thought of you today. I heard this song. And it reminded me of that song you used to say. Like, little moments like that, or my mom, or whatever.
The ache, dude. Ache. I accidentally called my mom's number last night, and I haven't done it since she died. I've been terrified of doing it, and then I called, and I'm like, fuck it, let me listen and see who's got her number now. It's just some guy, you know? I get like, this is John Pritt, you know, with a VLZ center. It's like, you're not my mom! What the fuck? But, man, that feeling, one of the things the Ram Dass people have taught me is I love, it's such a very simple saying, which is, the longing is the grace. And that feeling of longing is them. It's your connection to them. And that's
cool.
Yeah, it's fucking cool. So when that emerges, it's actually a connection to them. Like, you're feeling them. That's
real.
I know you want to call him and brag. You want to call him and brag.
There's a really cool story about my dad. Like, after he passed, and we sort of were passing his different stuff. And I got his... a director's chair with his name on it, and I was like, oh, that's cool, I'm gonna put that in my house. And then put it in my house, and then I sat down on it and it ripped. And it was just like, dad, it was such a dad joke. That's my dad, like, at his greatest. Those were his, like, fun things.
Exactly. Man, that's exactly how they do. I, you know, when my mom died, she has this little house on this island called Little Cumberland Island, and I went there with my girlfriend at the time, and I wanted to go out and float out on inner tubes, but you know, we didn't have any inner tubes, and really, you probably shouldn't. My mom's always terrified, like, we didn't want us to go out in those waters because there's jellyfish and sharks and shit. But you know, I was saying to my girl at the time, like, oh man, I wish we had some inner tubes. And we're walking down the path, and there's two inner tubes that the wind has blown up into the like brush, and so we take them, we go and float on the inner tubes. It's the best day. We're coming back, then this woman walks up and she's like, oh, you found the inner tubes. And she's like, oh, you're Deneen's son. And then she's like, you know, your mom said something to me. Your mom said, like, after she passes, she's gonna do some pretty amazing stuff.
Oh wow!
And I'm just like, whoa, that's just grace, that man. It's just like this beautiful, graceful little winks from the other side. That's like, no, don't. It's not that heavy. It's not that heavy, man.
Yeah.
And it's funny always too. It's funny ripping the director's chair is so hilarious.
Yeah, totally.
So funny, man. I mean, and it's on so many different levels too. I was just like talking to someone who's in AA, and they were telling, I love AA sayings, and one of them is like, get out of the director's chair. You ever hear that before?
Yeah.
You know, don't do that, because like the moment you were trying to control everything, you know, that's when you really start fucking up.
Yeah, it's true.
So I want, as I've been researching you, you're into horror movies, huh? Like,
I like them. I mean, I did this movie called The Tripper. I think you'd be interested.
It's
about a killer who's obsessed with Ronald Reagan, who hacks up hippies at an outdoor music festival. Yeah, so it's all like, they're all on acid, and, you know, this girl had a bad trip earlier, so she's like, I'm not doing it, and then she gets squirted with some, and she starts tripping, and that the killer thinks it's I forgot even her name, Ronald Reagan's daughter.
I don't know.
I forgot, but she had, like, a drug thing in reality, like, it was kind of public, but... So he calls her Peggy or whatever it is.
You know what I mean? That's
He's like all obsessed with her. His dogs are named like Nancy, and you know, all this. It's pretty trippy.
What's your favorite? Like, if you had to pick your favorite?
Shining, probably.
Fuck yeah.
Shining was great. I mean, Shining is the greatest because it's literally a man losing his mind.
Right.
Like, possessed by dark spirits, and he's like, I'm not gonna kill you.
Well, do you
blast your fucking head.
I'm gonna yeah. That's, do you like
Wendy?
Yes, the best. best.
The best. I mean, he was the greatest. I mean, that and Cuckoo's Nest and all those movies he was doing at the time. Jeez.
Oh, my God. Jack Nicholson in the fucking, in his prime.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. Once they invent the thing where you can go into the simulator and pick the thing and just to jump into Jack, prime Jack Nicholson, prime Nicholson.
That's some darkness, though, bro. There might be.
People thought he was the devil.
I mean, there was elements of that. I'm sure there was elements of that going on.
The parties he had, I've heard, is like you would leave his party and you would think to yourself, like, he's Satan.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he is the incarnation of Satan. Like, this man is a raging beast. This beautiful, talented, destructive vortex. Oh. Like, God forbid you should get drawn into his energetic. I mean, but man. I would love to experience that.
I know. Also, Brando was amazing. Just such a... I worked with him once.
No way.
Yeah, I got to work with him on this crazy movie called Free Money, and I think it was his last film. But I got to... I did it because, the director called me, and he was a friend, and he said, you want to do a couple scenes with Brando?
Fuck.
I was like, are you kidding me? So I went to, like, somewhere outside of Montreal, and it's snowing, and I flew in just for, like, the day, I think, and I meet him, and he's, we're, like, waiting to rehearse. They called us to the set too soon. He's like, you want to sit in my car? I was like, yeah, that would be great. Thank you, Mr. Brando.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And then, so I'm sitting behind him. He's in the passenger seat, and then his, I don't know if it was his girlfriend or his wife at the time, an Asian lady sitting right there, and she's really super sweet, and she's younger than him, but not too young that it's weird. And he's got this really weird haircut where they've cut the bald spot, so he's got like a shaved fake bald spot.
Yeah, yeah.
And his hair's kind of like a little, it's like a... Kim Jong-un with a bald spot. So it's like this weird like thing. And I'm sitting behind him just staring at the back of his head. And he's just asking me some questions. And just like, I was just so fucking nervous. And I'm sitting there and it's cold outside and I'm sniffling. And he's like, do you have a cold? And I said, I don't think so. It's just cold outside. And then so when he finally let me out, I was like, I didn't have the nerve to get back in the car. I was just like,
fuck.
But we did this scene together where I'm a used car dealer and I'm selling him this truck that the whole thing's about. He's finally retiring and getting this truck. So the truck was a big deal in the movie and he's got sons or something. So Charlie Sheen was in it as well. I didn't work with him though. But, but he's all of his humor was like based in like Three Stooges and like Buster Keaton,
right.
And I love that stuff, so I was totally game for it. He's like, "Why don't I shake the kid's hand and then I'll just he doesn't let go, he just keeps shaking and I find that annoying." I was like, "I love it." Anything you want. Why doesn't he give me the keys and then I'll go up to the. Truck and he had a hard time getting this truck because it was so high he
couldn't
get into it easily. So why wasn't the kid get on his hands and knees and I'll step on him and I get into the truck? And I was like, great, I love it. And the director was like, no, you can't. He was about 350, 400 at the time. So they were like, no, you can't. I was like, I've been doing this my whole life. The old I'm the youngest of, you know, five kids. Yeah. I've been the shelf or whatever, the stool for many a people. I could do this. He was like, no, you can't do that.
But imagine,
I do regret that.
Oh, because what a way to die. Being crushed to death by Marlon Brando.
Exactly.
That is the ultimate way to die. Yes. That you will be remembered forever, eternally.
Arquette, if I was just paralyzed, whatever. Fuck. It's fine.
Wolf Blitzer coming out talking about how you got paralyzed by fucking Marlon Brando. You like go into like one of those comas where like you have to use your eyes to communicate from then on. That would be amazing, man. God, would Brando visit you, do you think? Was he the type of person where you would have?
Yeah, I think so. He was really a kind, like, sweet, like, very spiritual, very, like, interesting guy. I was really upset when he died that there wasn't more of a like celebration of his life. I think because he like sent the Native American lady to get his Oscar or something, or then what happened with his son, unfortunately, like all that stuff kind of tainted like his thing, or just being difficult. I don't know what it was, but they didn't celebrate him the way like one of the greatest actors that ever lived just passed away, and like it was a blip, you know what I mean?
A blip. Yeah, and that sucks, that thing, because it's like the let's go back to Van Gogh, for example, right? Like that we celebrate him and his work, but nobody mentions like that was a stalker.
Yeah.
That was a depressed.
Yeah.
That dude sent his fucking ear.
That's hardcore.
That's deep stalking, deep abuse. That's as fucked up as you can get. And nobody, when they're looking at his art, not many people are like, you know, this guy was like a fucking abusive, psychotic. Well, because now, you know, if you the way Brando left with drama or whatever, that ends up obscuring somehow. I think that's a real sad. Yeah. Thing, you know, we got to figure out a way to like separate the water from the faucet, you know, because if it's good water, it's good water.
Totally. I have an amazing sculpture of him that Alexis had given me from the artist that did the one of James Dean up at the observatory, the same artist, and he delivered this sculpture to Brando, and he's like got his mouth open, and it's kind of I don't know, just expressive. The sculptor in general doesn't necessarily look a lot like him. It does, but he goes, "It looks like I'm ready to suck somebody off,"
which he did, right?
Yeah, he did. But the artist got so kind of offended that he didn't take the thing, and then the artist had given it to Alexis at some point.
I love that Brando is so familiar with himself that he knows the look he gets on his face when he's about to suck someone off. That's a great actor, you know, because he's like studying himself all the time.
Oh, man.
That's so fun. Who was it that what is the famous picture of? There's a picture of him, right? Who is it that he's sucking off?
I don't know. Was it James Dean?
I think he sucked off James Dean.
I think it's in that picture, yeah.
Wow.
That crazy picture. I also, the same place that has the picture, so what used to be at like Soap Plant or something, you could find stuff like that. I don't know if they have that stuff anymore.
Go ahead, sorry.
No. But there was one of Walt Disney where he draws Minnie Mouse with boobs on a chalkboard.
Oh, wow.
That's another good one.
But would you, like, if you were James Dean, if like we get the simulator running, pop back in time, we get to pick these like various like legends, pop back into James Dean's body, and you're in that room with Marlon Brando, and he's like, "I want to suck you off."
Oh, God.
Would you say no?
I think I would. I don't know. I've had uncomfortable experiences in my life, and I don't, not that I ever blew anyone or been blown by a guy.
But it's Brando.
I know, but still, I grew up sharing a room with a transgender person.
Right.
So I like, you know, went through, when I was going through like adolescence, I was like, "Oh, hope I'm not gay." Like, that's what I was worried about, because I like dressing up and I like having fun. And I like being, I don't know, not that that's like some gay trait, having fun. But
yeah, you're gay, man. Having fun. I mean, I was going to tell you, you're gay.
But even like wearing a dress, I don't know. I've like, have you ever cross-dressed?
A Burning Man.
Yeah. I always am so uncomfortable. I don't know if it's like old stuff from sharing a room with Alexis, but it all just makes me so uncomfortable. So even if it was James Dean or Marlon Brando, I'd be like, ooh, it just,
I don't think it'd be the best. I don't think it'd be like, it's like, it's not going to be a great moment. But I'm just saying, it's like afterwards, you're like, well,
it's a good
Marlon.
Story.
Yeah, it's a great story. Like, Marlon Brando sucked my cock. It's like, what's better than that? Anytime you see a Brando film, you're like, yeah, that guy sucked my dick.
Well, I used to be really into like, if I was working with a girl or somebody or like somebody, an actress or something, I'd put heat seeking missiles and like do everything to like go out with them, meet them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I used to be really about that. And I don't know. It's just kind of it's a weird thing to get obsessed with because, yes, it's good story. But aside from that, it becomes, you don't For one, a lot of the time you don't want to tell those stories because you don't want to you know, share stuff that...
That's right.
And then if you ever do slip and share something, sometimes people then deny it or... and then you're like, what, are you embarrassed by it or something? Or right. I thought we actually did date. Maybe I shouldn't be talking about it. Is that what's going on? So I don't really know how to deal with that.
You've been in one of those relationships that is a, where like people are taking pictures of you at the beach and stuff.
Yeah,
right?
That was a crazy time because it was like peak of friendsness. So, and it was also this weird time where the paparazzi culture was exploding. It was like pre-TMZ. So it was like, you know, right at the beginning of all this stuff and all these, like, for some reason at the beginning, there were a bunch of gangsters got guns. And it was like, so you were like, you know, you were legitimately scared. Like you were going to either get robbed or like, you know what I mean? And then you just had a baby. So you're protective of the baby. You're like, get the fuck away from this baby. You know, have some respect and all this stuff. But I once then saw myself back, the reactions, the pictures, me almost getting a fight with the paparazzi. And I was like, oh, and I was looking at the camera and I was like, oh, it's not even, so nobody knows what he looks like. No one sees what I'm seeing. So all they're seeing is me being aggressive and that's not me. So that's, you know, now I'm projecting an image of myself that I'm not. So then it changed my whole relationship with paparazzi. Then And I also didn't care at some point. I was just like, you're doing a job and I get it, you know, but it's the old, you know, drink poison and expect someone else to die. You know what I mean?
Wow. That whole thing.
So you're like, oh, you're eating yourself up for nothing.
Right. But man, I mean that you did that. I mean, like you're like one of the things like, I was talking to a friend of mine. He's a famous guy, but he's like, you know, I just want to keep it right here.
Right.
He's like, I want to keep it right
here.
That's
smart. That's a smart guy.
I don't want to go past that. Because once you go past a certain point,
yeah,
that's it, man. You got to live in gated communities. You got to, like, you.
Absolutely.
You're isolated.
Yeah.
And you went through, I mean, you were like a sparking celebrity. You were in... Yeah, you guys are on magazines at the grocery store and shit, you know?
Yeah. We were on The Bag once, which was awesome. So at all the airports, there's this one company that has a bag. And so The Bag had the cover of some magazine we were on. So that bag lasted longer than this cover did. And it traveled all through, like, the world.
Wow.
Which was funny. I mean, it's not really something to be proud of any stretch, but it was just funny to see the bag. I don't know.
To me, that stuff would start, if anything was going to make me like spin out, that it's that. That's where I would start kind of losing it. It's like seeing my picture. Yeah.
It does make you spin out a lot. There's this whole like, it's just such a weird, weird game that we're in because, you know, every major, like, superstar that I've ever met has a narcissistic, like, element, like, hardcore. Like, they really are really incredibly confident, incredibly kind of narcissistic and full of themselves. It's kind of like you revolve around their world. And I get that as an actor to be able to have that confidence. So you have to have that anyway to perform, to step up, to take risks, to be sure of yourself. I mean... Doubt doesn't work very well in performance because it just kind of it's that negative voice that just starts attacking you. But confidence and being able to feel free enough to, you know, try to tap into something that's maybe closer to this character and grounded and reality and all that is something that's kind of pretty exciting, you know. And so I don't know. This goes back to the narcissistic thing.
Yes.
So I was obsessed and I was talking about this and I said to my therapist, I said, do you have any narcissistic the patients? And he said, no, you know why? I said, why? They don't need me. Wow. I was like, whoa, that's how like, so this guy is like, there's no remorse about like, if our president cheated on his, you know what I mean? I will, if anything ever happens, be like, smash my head into a, you know, window. I mean, I have scars all over from like smashing my head through windows.
For
some reason, that was my go-to because it always would end the fight. Like, I don't like to fight. So I'd be like, oh, you want to fight? Blood everywhere. Fight's over.
Holy
I didn't hit anybody. Shit. I don't, you know, except myself. But it was like this whole thing. For some reason, I was incredibly, you know, self-abusive. And like the pain there would take away the pain of like here or whatever.
Wow. So yeah. You were a cutter.
A bit of a cutter, but more of a smasher, like head smasher. Like,
what's the reaction of someone you're in a fight with?
It's something also. People punch stuff all the time, break their hands. Like, it's that whole, like.
You're turning it all inward. That's why you get depressed. This is, fuck, man.
Yeah. But, you know, friends laughing, like, enjoying life, children, like, I don't know how not to make life as stressful as it is. I mean, is your life, do you feel it's stressful?
See, I go to these Ram Dass retreats. Thank God. And they've taught me this mindfulness practice. Yeah. My life is stressful.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go into like I don't smash my head through windows yet. Though I'm gonna remember that technique.
It's a horrible thing.
But you know the idea is it's like we're gonna. Well, it teaches you to where you're stuck, and it gives you the. A way that you can forgive yourself for smashing your head in the window.
Right.
Forgive yourself for the bullshit because it's like, that's just part of what we are. That's part of the pattern. Right. And then it's the practice of mindfulness kind of teaches you to sort of put some space in between the thought forms and what you, and your actual identity, which is a soul, which is an infinite being that's having this very temporary experience as a human.
Wow.
And so
that's amazing.
That being said, I'm still a fucking deep, deep, deep fried cunt. I mean, I can, you know what I mean?
That's an amazing term. I went to this thing called the Hoffman practice or something, which is a retreat. Which is really an interesting thing. It started in the 60s or 70s. They have them all over the world. The one I went to was in Napa. And it was pretty cool, man. It, like, you do all these things where you write a list of your resentments and all, you know, from you trace them as far back as you can and you list them all. Then you spend, like, days beating a pillow with a wiffle ball bat.
Cool.
And you just like boom boom like until you like you say this one like that kid that you know the teacher that brought me in front of you know school when I was in third grade and like you know made a fool of me or the teacher that made me read in front of class and made me nervous about reading for the rest of my life like stuff like that. So you just beat the hell out of it and then you sort of address all your behaviors and you know all your resentments and all these things. You write letters and you write letters to your parents, even if they're alive or dead, and you bury stuff and you do all this really interesting work. You have a lot of silent time.
Do you feel like it helped?
It did help. Yeah, it helps. But I'm really bad at the ongoing practice of things.
Yeah.
I don't like, yeah, I like, I can learn it. I can do it. It'll help me. And then I'll be back to my own kind of behavior and to a certain extent.
Well, that's
I've gotten better though. I'm not as like, you know, making the same mistakes I've always made before.
Well, that's the, yeah. And what, one of the things I love about the lineage I'm in is like the concept. It's like, some people might even see it as somewhat nihilistic because they're like, oh no. You see, You this and this go around, you really might not work out for you. Like it's because we keep doing this over and 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 over again. So that is like, don't, it's really not about being in a hurry. And it's really not about like, cause what starts happening is you begin to crucify yourself with your practice. So you have this idea of like, oh, here's where I'm good. And now I'm the bad boy.
Right. I know. I hate that. That's what my whole thing, one of my main like psychological things I've had to get over in my life is wanting to be the good boy.
Yeah.
For my mom who like had such a rough life and family was so crazy and our family was so crazy that I'll be the good boy. Like I'll be the one she doesn't have to worry about.
Yeah.
And then like, I, you know, started getting crazy myself and doing crazy stuff and I'm not the good boy anymore. Then I'm bad.
Yeah.
So if I'm the bad boy, let's go real bad. Like,
yeah, let's go deep. Man. You know, I came home drunk and like I had some DMT and my friends had, you know, have you ever smoked DMT?
No, that's what I heard. It's pretty interesting.
Well, it's amazing. But you know, the person who had shown me how to do it is like, it, and many people have attached to it a really, it's a deep religious experience. Right. It should perhaps be preceded by fasting, you know, something called a dieta if you're going to do ayahuasca, pure cleansing, purification, prayers to, you know, like my friend who did it with me did this beautiful prayer, like, you know, may this be like the jaguar that eats the bones of everything in the forest. May it eat your darkness and all this stuff. It was beautiful and sweet. But I came home drunk and I'm like, ah, fuck that sappy, sentimental fucking bullshit. What happens if I smoke this goddamn DMT when I'm drunk? I think I just eaten shit on stage. So I'm just like pissed. I'm like, I'm going to just smoke DMT in the wrong way, in the deep wrong way. So I smoke it and go into this space. And it's not like a voice talks to you, but something is conveyed to you. And what it was conveyed to me is, we love you.
Yeah.
You're the one who's saying that you're bad. You're the one who's saying this is horrible. You're the one who's putting all this heavy shit on you.
Right.
This is just something you're doing. Do you think you can be bad? That was the concept. Whoa, is like, yeah,
I love that,
yeah, dude. You're carrying that thing. And so this, the thing that, and I'm sorry guys, I've said this a few times because I love this book by Pema Chodron. It's called The Wisdom No Escape. In the very beginning of this book, she says, people think I'm going to start meditating to become a better person. Well, this is an aggression against the self that you are right now. We don't want to become better people. We want to become who we are and feel what we're feeling and be in this thing right now. So it sort of like destroys the whole, that feeling of like, oh man, I'm really not doing it right now. You're not doing it right now. And that is part of the practice. To think that you're not practicing, but you're aware. You just watch, like, oh yeah, right now I'm drinking a little too much.
Yeah.
Right now I'm a little depressed. Right now I'm gonna, and you just, that very simple shift from being in it to watching it. Wow, man, it like really does change things a little bit for me, at least.
Yeah,
it has,
totally,
you know?
Man. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Watch the beer. Actually, I was kicking around the idea of a book. It's just such a cheesy title. You know, Ram Dass wrote a book called Be Here Now. I was thinking Drink Beer Now, a book about mindfully drinking.
By the way, it's needed. It's needed. When I was in the Hoffman, I was like, the whole thing was like, oh, I was drinking back then too. And you have to be sober for the whole experience and all that. And I was like, two drink maximum.
Well, you know, I was, there's this teacher, Sharon Salzberg, and I was at one of these Ram Dass retreats. They let me interview them. And I was saying to her, like, well, I mean, what isn't meditation? You know, like I at the time Westworld was running and they're all drinking whiskey on Westworld. So when Westworld came on, I pour like a stiff shot of whiskey and pretend I was like in Westworld drinking whiskey.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, isn't that a practice? And she was like, well, it's a practice, but you're practicing the wrong thing. So you don't want to get, you don't want to get delusional and fool yourself into thinking that putting poison into your body is an actual path. But simultaneously, instead of like doing that act, whether it's drinking or smoking or sex addiction or whatever the fucking thing it is, mindlessly, just add the element of watching yourself do it.
Yeah.
The pre-drink, the feeling you get before you have the drink. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, like, totally.
Just be in the moment as you're consuming the thing, you know, instead of trying to imagine that. You just make it so you're not really a bad person anymore.
Right, totally. I mean, that is really that negative voice, the monkey that grabs that thought and it'll just run havoc through your brain, is really the most dangerous of all the, like, things.
Well, I think that's what we're pouring the booze on, really, is like that thing. And that thing just is going to jump in whenever it can.
Yeah.
No matter, you could be the most sober person on earth and the thing was going to pop in. And like,
well,
that's, I mean, it's Nafsu, Satan. Yeah. You know, it's the thing that like, it's the great imposter because it wants to be the center of attention. It's the root of all, it's the ultimate of narcissists, isn't it?
Oh God, you want to hear one of the worst narcissist stories?
I'd love to.
And this is like family genetic stuff. So my dad like wanted to be an actor, always tried out for the actor studio. They never accepted him. So it was like this, he dated the same girl as James Dean.
Wow.
She stole his jacket, a red jacket, and then James Dean borrowed it. That's the rumor that happened. And then he had a the costume director get one for Rebel Without a Cause. That's whoa. That's how the story goes. But it's all wow. that time back in the 60s and like early 60s in New York and all this stuff. So he never got accepted. And it was always kind of like, you know, weird for him. And so he's always trying. And his dad was famous. So he's kind of like trying to, you know, do his own path, like true actor in New York. So he gets a great play at Summerstock, and he goes up, and he's really excited about it. He invites his dad. His dad's at the height of his fame at this point. So he goes, and they have a great first act, and they go back, and they're preparing for the second act, and then he hears all this laughter, and all the whole room is like going crazy. And he peeks his head out, and his dad had brought his Charlie Weaver costume, put it on, and entertained the theater
wow.
during intermission. Jeez. And it was just such a like a wow, that's like so crazy, like wow. attention. Like that's like the worst story I've ever heard. Like my dad, like so that stuck with him his whole career, and like just kind of like just that was just painful. Thing
that is so fucked up.
It's so fucked
mindless. Up. That's robotic. That's an automat. That's some kind of evil robotic move to do that. You just gotta grab the attention.
Oh my gosh, what is that?
Oh, it's vampiric.
Yeah, it's insane.
A narcissist is a vampire.
Yeah, yeah.
Is a form of vampire. I think vampirism is actually somewhat based on like because they're narcissists. A vampire is a fucking narcissist.
Yeah,
sucks your blood, but they're also beautiful and like they draw you in.
Yeah,
they're
yeah,
not
yeah,
like
yeah.
you know they suck you in. They're beautiful. They're like they act like you. They want you feel lucky to be in their presence. You know, and I you know one of my dear friends, she like has dated narcissists and like she's like that's tough. She gets sucked in by them and she's explaining it to me.
Yeah,
and I'm like going fucking like white, and I said to her, "I'm like, am I a narcissist? Please say no." She's like, "You're not a fucking narcissist."
the fact that you asked tells you you're not a narcissist. But a narcissist would never ask if they were a narcissist; they wouldn't care.
Well, they might. As a form of manipulation.
Oh, yeah. You know absolutely. What I mean? Yes, they would care to like.
Because my friend's a therapist, and he says sometimes narcissists will get therapists.
Oh, shit.
Not because they need them, but because they want to use them as another thing to impress with their, oh, wow. You know what I mean?
Oh, like magic. Their magic soul sauce.
I don't. You know the Jung's idea of the shadow being reflected in the leader? Have you ever heard that? The society shadow can get reflected into the leader.
Oh, this is so sad and scary for right now.
Yeah, and that's the idea is like Trump is actually a reflection of the narcissistic personality disorder that's afflicted all of us. And he's like us, that's us prancing around up there, right. You know?
I believe that, and I think that's so we can learn.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what not to be.
What not to be.
Yeah, exactly. And that's...
Or like that Clooney would be better. No, I'm just kidding.
Do you think he's going to run?
No. I would want his wife to run. His wife to be president, him to be.
But do you think that's going to happen? You think Clooney's kicking that idea around a little bit?
No, I don't think so. But he is really such a nice, like, great person. Like, he really is one of the kinder people you meet.
My brother's worked with him. My brother shoots video, and Clooney took him out to, like, Africa because he doesn't work out there. And, like, that's what my brother said. He's the sweetest guy on earth.
Yeah, greatest guy.
You're the greatest guy.
You
man.
Are, man.
Thank you so Thank much you. For coming in and having this conversation.
This is an honor. I love it.
Likewise. Is there? How do people find you? What's coming up?
I don't know. I just did a documentary called Survivor's Guide to Prison, which is really a look at the broken prison system. Amazing director, Matthew Cook, directed it. It did really well, and people are watching it. It gives you little tips on if you encounter an out-of-control officer and whatnot. So
cool.
What to do there. Yeah, it's on iTunes right now and Amazon, but it'll be on Netflix soon. So that...
Beautiful.
Yeah, Amanda and Jack Go Glamping just came out on Netflix. So
beautiful.
That's about it for now.
Thank you, sir. All the links. You. Hare Krishna. Very nice chatting with you.
You too.
That was David Arquette, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. A big thank you to HelloFresh for sponsoring this episode. Go to HelloFresh.com and use offer code Duncan30 to get $30 off your first order. Please don't forget to subscribe to us over at patreon.com. I love you guys, and I will see you soon. We have an excellent episode coming out with a great Mark Duplass. Hare Krishna.